Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ted McClintock. I represent the appellant, Leslie Franklin. Basically, this is sort of a one-issue appeal that is based around the two interviews that were the subject of a suppression hearing. Those interviews, one was admitted in court and one was not. The second one was admitted in court. The first one was not admitted. I think that the issue in the first one that brings itself to the court is really who did the interview and what the context of what that interview was, because the basis of this appeal is primarily voluntariness. We did raise an issue involving due process involved with the fact that the children were removed, and in large part, I believe that that due process and the cases that go along with that has a lot to do with what the overall assessment of voluntariness should have been. I don't disagree with the opposing side's statement as to exactly what the case law is and what the concerns are that need to be addressed, whether or not a case is or a statement is voluntary. And so going through those, I think that where the fact that the children were removed becomes important is it goes very strongly to the considerations of whether or not that interrogation that occurred second, that happened at the police station, was actually voluntary and should have been suppressed by the trial court.
Let me interrupt you, Mr. McClintock. I just want to make sure I understand what you said about the first interview. I think you're conceding that the suppression issue itself is moot since nothing came in.
Right. As far as the content, I think it is moot.
But the argument is that it may have tainted the second one, and that's why we need to think about it, or I'm just not sure I understand.
It's sort of that it tainted it, and I know that's sort of a roundabout answer, but what I think the more important thing is that both officers were present. And the officer that conducted the second interview that was a short time later is actually the officer that said, I'm taking control of this. I'm going to take the children. It can happen either the easy way or the hard way. And in essence, takes his children away from him and leaves. It's the same officer that said, I'm going to take the children one way or another, that comes back, requests him to come to the police station, gets him down to the police station, and then does the interview at that time in a closed room in the police department. And I think the evaluation that was put forth by opposing counsel in this about what those assessments are, and the first one I
Mr. McClintock, I want to make sure I understood your answer to Judge Gabriel's question.
Sorry.
Are you arguing or not arguing that the first interview tainted the voluntariness of the second interview?
I think that there is taint involved because of the way, especially the closing arguments were argued, and I think that the first interview in and of itself set up the demeanor of what occurred in the second one. So yes, I am contending that it tainted legally what occurred in the second interview.
Did you make that argument in your opening brief?
Not directly. We did not make it that way because I think it's more tangential and, as I said, more related to the voluntariness argument than the actual taint argument of the first one. So to answer your question, I'm not trying to beat around the bush. I think that legally it's more of an issue, as I've stated, that it affected what happened in the second interview more than it is a legal taint from the first.
It's not the content of what the defendant said to officer, I think it's Herbin Street or something like that, not the contents of what he said, but the circumstances that led up to that interview. Is that what you're saying? Because Officer Norcross wasn't there during the first interview, was she?
She was not there. She was present at the beginning and said, going to take the children.
And she left.
She left with the children.
Right, so the content of the interview doesn't involve her at all, but the circumstances under which it came about.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. The content of the interview, just to clear, the content of the interview with Herbin Street was not admitted at trial.
Correct.
So I'm still struggling with why is that not a moot issue, what happened there?
I think in essence it is moot, other than the context of how it occurred, what it set up for, and the way that both officers were present, and that the officer that took the children was present at the beginning and onset of that interview, how that taints the second interview. And so when we're talking about taint, I think it taints it because when she arrives and does the second, or when they meet at the police station and do the second interview, he is talking to the officer that took his children just a short time previous. And looking at the concerns that they have, the they put down, the first one that is to be considered under the case law is that, was the defendant in custody, was he aware, was he free to leave? That is probably the most favorable concern to them, because they go through and it's testified to that he was told he was free to leave, he wasn't in custody, although it was at a police station, it was an enclosed room. And then they go through, was there a Miranda warning, which is to be considered if there is a voluntariness issue. It isn't necessarily, if there isn't custody, it isn't binding, but it is one of the things that the courts say has to be concerned with. Was there a Miranda warning in this case? And one of our big issues is the fact that the children were taken away, the fact that this is the officer that took the children, made this a non-voluntary, involuntary statement. And one of the ways that could have been at least corrected or been more balanced under this assessment was if Miranda had in fact been read.
Well, how is that involuntary? I mean, we're looking at, for voluntariness, coercion. So here the officer said, I'm going to take the children, and she said they will be returned. Your client, she calls your client, will you come down for an interview? He drives himself to the, by the time he gets there, the children had already been returned to the mother. So how do we have a voluntary? You say, since the children are taking it, it's involuntary. I guess I'm having trouble understanding.
Well, and I didn't interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
That I think the issue is that she's made it very clear that the children will be returned to him and his ability to be with the children if this doesn't pan out and if the investigation is satisfactory to them. So what that puts in his mind going into that interview is, as a layperson, what exactly do I have to say? I don't want to anger them. And if you look at the closing arguments in this case, the district attorney went on and on and on about what, how appropriate his reactions were. Is that the man? He said no, but he didn't say no in the right way. Look at his, the way he responded to the question. He seems more concerned with arguing that he didn't have full intercourse with the victim than whether he didn't have any kind of contact with the victim. All those kind of things were argued in closing. And this was a gentleman who had had his children taken away by an officer of the law who doesn't have experience with the law, which again is one of the concerns that go into whether it is voluntary.
But Mr. McClintock, I guess I'm still confused. Before the interview, the second interview, the children had been returned already. So how does that issue matter at all to the second interview?
Because they were returned to the mother who was, as this case went on, was part of the situation of keeping the children, and they had not been returned to him, nor had he been told that he was going to have any contact with the children. This is the same officer that took them. She interviews the children. She returns them to the mother. He then is called and summoned to the police station, and he is never told he's allowed to have contact with his children.
But he's allowed to leave. I mean, he lives with the mother, right? I mean, they're not separated or anything. They live in the same house.
At the time, they were, yes.
Sure. And so the children return to the mother, so mom and the children are in his house. He gets up at the end of the second interview, basically, physically announces he's done without having to say it. The officer walks into the door. He goes home.
Well, I think whether or not the children are still in the custody of the Department of Human Services or in custody of the police department, it has been made very clear to him that his custody and his ability to be with his children are in serious jeopardy, and they were taken away from him against his will. The same officer calls him down there. So I think the effect on the children that had been removed from him and that they had not been told that he was going to be able to have the children back has the same effect whether they were still sitting with the police officers or sitting in the Department of Human Services office, because that effect, that chilling effect on what he was going to be able to say voluntarily in that statement was real. And the closing statement that they used basically put him on trial in his statement for everything that he had said and everything that he was trying to defend himself, because he wouldn't call her a liar, although he said he didn't do it. And so everything that they were doing was basically focusing on how he reacted to that in a situation where he was in fact trying to answer it correctly, not just for the truth, but to deal with the fact that they had told him they were taking his children. So I think that even though they may have been returned to the mother, they weren't returned to him, and they were certainly still in jeopardy from being removed from him permanently, and he did not know what the answer needed to be. Well, and I think that is what makes it involuntary.
It sounds like you're suggesting what was involuntary was not his willingness to talk to the officer, but the answers he gave to her questions. He was trying to tailor his answers Well, to get the children back? Is that involuntary?
Well, because the way he has to answer is different. I think it does make it involuntary because he's not voluntarily just telling the truth.
He could have refused to answer anything.
He could have. That's true.
But instead, what he did, he's tried to tailor his answer to give her the answer he thinks she wants to get so that he can get the children back. Is that involuntary?
I think it is involuntary in this situation where the children are at issue, because all of us have to deal with that fact where a child's involved trying to figure out what that is in the short term here. And I think the answer could have been, under these standards, is they could have read him as Miranda rights and made it more clear to him exactly what the situation was, which is why I think voluntariness relies upon not only all the other concerns, but it does include Miranda. And I think it could be thrown back the same way. Why didn't they, if they were taking him to the police department and they obviously already had statements, why didn't they just throw the Miranda at him? Because they wanted to live off of this confusion, this fear, and the fact that they had taken the child. They were using that to create the statement from him to get him to talk in an involuntary fashion.
But didn't Officer Norquist tell him he didn't have to talk to her? I mean, I know she didn't even form Miranda paragraphs, but she did say you don't have to talk. You don't have to talk if you don't want to. And you're free to leave, and you're not under arrest.
And our argument is that because of the situation involving the children and
yes.
the taking away of
yes.
the children, that really wasn't a real option for a father yes. to make at that point.
He felt impelled to give her the answers that he thought she wanted to hear to get the children back. That's your theory, right?
Yes. And that's
is there any case that says those circumstances amount to an involuntary statement?
Not specifically, but that is why we brought in the due process clause and the issues involving with there's due process and moving somebody away from their children. Because this is a case that brings into very, very stark relief that by taking those children and then the way the closing arguments were processed, that clearly the way he was answering things and the way he felt compelled, as Your Honor stated, that was a situation that
I said impelled, by the way, not compelled.
Mr. McClintock, this due process argument with respect to taking the children, did you make that argument in the suppression proceedings?
I was not trying
to. Was that argument made in the suppression proceedings?
It wasn't made directly. My position is that the suppression motion itself raised issues of the Fifth and 14th Amendment implicitly or specifically in their motion. And I believe that those grounds of voluntariness and invoking the Fifth and 14th Amendment would include due process.
So you think the general reference to due process preserves any argument that might be later based on due process?
I think in this case, combined with the fact that there was a voluntariness argument and the Fifth Amendment was the basis of this, that it does. I have 2 minutes and 10 seconds left, and I would ask to reserve that for a while.
You may, Mr. McClintock. Thank you very much. Ms. Robler?
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. The issue before this court today is the voluntariness of the defendant's statements. And critical to any finding of involuntariness is the existence of coercive governmental conduct, either physical or mental, that played a significant role in inducing a confession or an inculpatory statement. That's the bedrock question, was this statement or statements coerced? And the closest case I was able to find was the People v. Medina case I cited in my brief. In that case, a defendant's confession was deemed involuntary because the confession was induced by a detective's threat to have the defendant's child taken away from both parents unless the defendant confessed to injuring the child. The defendant then confessed in order that the child could remain in the custody of her mother. So we have two critical differences with the present case. The first is that although the children were removed temporarily from the defendant's custody, this was not used as a promise or a threat by the officers here. I mean, the officer, the female officer, was very clear in saying, the children are coming with me so they can have forensic interviews. So It was not conditioned on the defendant making any statements of any sort to the officers. So we don't have this cause and effect in the present case. Moreover, with regard to effect, the defendant didn't confess. He didn't make any inculpatory statements. His will was simply not overborne. And if we look at the two interviews, we can see that, or hear it in the case of the first interview. In the first interview, he's asked repeatedly by the male investigator if he can take photographs inside the house. And the defendant repeatedly refuses permission to take photographs inside the house. Thus, his will is not overborne by any coercive conduct. Similarly, in the second interview, the female investigator tries to get the defendant to agree to take a polygraph exam, and he refuses to take a polygraph exam. So we see that there isn't his will being overborne. To the contrary, he is exercising his free will, and he gets up at the end of the second interview, leaves the room. So he clearly has the ability to do so, and he's not being coerced by these officers.
Ms. Rohrbaugh, prior to the second interview, was the defendant informed that the children had been returned to their mother?
You know, that's not clear. I mean, what we have is the second officer's testimony at the suppression hearing, that she went with the children, the first two children, to the children's center. And then she was there while all three children were interviewed, because the third child was taken care of by the defendant's wife subsequently. And so what she testified to was that after the interviews were completed, she went back to the sheriff's office and she talked to the first investigator about his interview with the defendant. And then she called the defendant and asked if he would be willing to come in. So I don't know what was especially communicated to the defendant by the officer. I also don't know, of course, what sort of communication the defendant had with his wife. He was not in custody, presumably could have spoken to her by telephone. We don't know that. He did not testify at the suppression hearing, so we just don't know what he knew.
Thank you.
While we've interrupted here, Ms. Rohrbaugh, let me ask you a question about the record that at least confused me. The court here found that the investigators told Mr. Franklin that he'd get his kids back if things didn't pan out. I guess I'm not quite sure where the court got that from. And I guess I'd be curious in your reaction. Are we bound by that finding? If so, that seems more coercive than what it seems to me the officer actually said, but I'm a little troubled by that finding and what we do with it.
Well, Your Honor, in reviewing my notes from the defendant's conversation with the first investigator, and I could go back to counsel table and look at my notes.
No, it's okay.
But it seems to me that there's an exchange between the officer and the defendant saying something like, we're investigating these allegations and, you know, they may turn out to be nothing and this may be the end of it. So I think that may be the, if it doesn't pan out, okay, the court is referring to colloquially, is this understanding that if the allegations which were reported to social services were not borne out by the interviews with the children, then that would be the end of the investigation. But I think in terms of saying if it doesn't pan out, that the condition of panning out is the statements made by the children in their interviews, the forensic interviews at the Children's Center. I don't think there's any connection to any statements made by defendants.
Thank you.
The remaining sort of pieces of this legal issue are two that are not preserved. One is the due process issue that was not raised in the trial court. The other is the question of taint, whether the first statement in some way tainted the second statement. That was not raised in the opening brief, but I made some comments about it in the answer brief, and I can talk a little bit about it today. In terms of due process, as I said, this is a claim that wasn't raised below, but I don't think it's a freestanding claim. The two bases for such a claim are a 1983 federal civil rights suit, which is a civil case. And then the other is a DNN case, also a civil case. So to the extent that there's this due process right, the remedy would seem to be civil in nature. Moreover, both of those cases say that while it can be a due process violation to separate a parent and child, they both go so far as to say separation of the child from her parents for a few hours in an effort to obtain an assurance she had not been abused was not sufficient to constitute a violation of that right. So there's simply no violation, even if there is such a right. And as I said, I don't think it's a standalone claim. It either has to be a part of the voluntariness analysis, the coercion question, or it would be a civil rights claim. But even as a civil rights claim, I think it would fail under the circumstances, the very brief time that the children were removed.
Ms. Rohrbaugh, I noticed you mentioned today in your brief that that particular due process argument was not made in the suppression proceedings, and you cited several cases that would say that appellate courts don't consider issues that were not raised for suppression below. Do you know of any cases showing, stating the opposite, that appellate courts can address an issue in support of suppression that was not raised in the trial court?
Well, I think that often the way this court has framed it is that the court has discretion. It seems to me, I don't know if the Salyer case says that exactly, but I think this court has sometimes felt that it has discretion to consider things that were not raised below. But it's my position that the court should not, and that's because the prosecution has the burden at a suppression hearings. The prosecution has to have notice of what it is it's defending against. And so if the prosecution and the court don't have notice of the claim, then it can't be defended by the prosecution and it can't be resolved at the trial court. And clearly it was not among those claims resolved here.
Thank you.
With regard to the taint question, and I cited in my brief Oregon v. Elstad and also People versus Mendoza-Rodriguez. And the taint analysis essentially ends if the first statement is voluntary, then the second statement also being voluntary is not tainted by it. If the first statement is in fact coerced, then the court looks at a number of factors like the time that has passed between the confessions, a change in place in the interrogations, and a change in the identity of the interrogators. And I would submit to you that if for some reason this court were to decide that the first statement were involuntary, that nonetheless would not taint the second statement because the defendant chose to come to the police station, which is a change in circumstances. It was a different interviewer from the first interviewer, and thus there would be no taint. Does this court have other questions?
I have a question. Assume for the moment that it was error to admit the statements at trial because they were coercion or otherwise. Why is it harmless or not harmless? My understanding was none of the statements were incriminating. He didn't confess anything. He continually denied the allegations. So why did the prosecutor admit them, and how did the prosecutor use them such that it might bear on the question about harmless or not?
Well, I'll begin by saying that it certainly would be my position that admission of the statements would in fact be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the defendant did not in fact inculpate himself. Now, I think part of the reason that the statements were admitted were to show the defendant's demeanor, and also because I think that if there's a taped interview that is not shown, the jury thinks that somehow something is being kept from it. I think that what might be considered so-called inferentially inculpatory of in the statements would be the fact that the defendant was asked, for example, about his work schedule, which might corroborate not to corroborate the victim's allegations. There's also the question of whether the defendant knows the victim to be untruthful, which again can sort of corroborate or not the victim's statements. So I suppose those things might be called inferentially inculpatory, but I think it's sort of a stretch.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'm trying to understand how this case is different from Medina. In Medina, what you describe in your brief, the police told the defendant that the children are going to be taken away unless the defendant confessed to a specific negative act. That probably wasn't what happened here. But if I understand you correctly, the police said the children will be returned if it
hands out, that's the language that we're dealing with?
I think the language that Judge Gabriel referred to was, if it doesn't pan out.
If it doesn't pan out, the children will not be returned?
If it doesn't pan out, the children will be returned. Panning out being one of those, I said.
Okay, therefore, pan out doesn't refer to defendant statements, it must refer to what the, that's what you're saying.
That's my understanding.
Therefore, it's completely different from Medina in the sense that it's not talking about what the defendant had to say, it's talking about what the, quote, I don't call it a threat, but the comment by the police officer didn't relate to what the defendant had to say, it related to what the children might say.
Right, because the, there had been, if you recall from the facts, that the sleepover party where the victim related the allegations to friends, the friends related it to their mother, the mother made a social services report, by which time, you know, it's third-hand hearsay. So it all depends on whether she repeats the same allegations and whether her sister's made similar allegations in the forensic interviews. But again, I'm sorry if I didn't make it clear earlier, but I think to the extent that we're talking about the allegations panning out, that would be dependent on what the children said and not at all on what the defendant said.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no other questions from this court, I would ask you to affirm the defense conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Robaugh. Mr. McClintock, you've got about 2 minutes and 20 seconds. No, 2 minutes and 4 seconds. My apologies. Okay.
Just in answer to a few of the things and that was going on there, as far as the concern, and I think the question that was asked about whether he was aware that the children had been returned, there certainly, and I agree that it's unclear, but there certainly is nothing that I can see from the record that indicated that they affirmatively told him that when he came to talk the second time. The standards that I was going through that are cited by opposing counsel, was a Miranda warning, nor was there an opportunity to converse with counsel? No. Was it a statement made by interrogation or volunteer? This is clearly an interrogation. The threat or promise, and that's one of the things that I think we were just discussing is in regards to, was this a threat by the police? It can be overt or implied. And I think by taking the children, there is certainly an implied threat. And the fact that the children were taken from his custody and there was statements and findings of fact by the court below that it was going to happen either the easy way or the hard way and that it would have to pan out. And I understand that the opposing counsel is saying that that means what the children say, but it was about the investigation. And the investigation included what he had to say, and he knew that, even as a layperson. So when he went down there and when he made those statements, he was under that implied and, frankly, I believe, direct threat as to what exactly could be said. And the truth is, they took his statement, and even though it isn't a direct confession, as so often defense attorneys warn their clients, when you start talking to the police, they're going to pick apart what you say and, frankly, in this case, how you said it, because his denials weren't strong enough. His posture wasn't good enough, his demeanor wasn't right, and therefore all of those things led to them saying that those things were there. And the other thing, and I have 8 seconds, is the defendant's mental and physical condition. He had just had his children taken away, and he had no strength to bring the justice system. I would ask respectfully that this case be reversed and remanded for the trial.
Thank you, Mr. McClintock. We thank you as well. Again, Ms. Robaugh. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. I want to say we appreciate particularly your driving up from Colorado Springs, Mr. McClintock. I personally think oral argument is helpful to the court, and I personally would like to hear more of it, so I'm glad that you're willing to do that for us. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the court's 10 o'clock docket and its docket for the day, so the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may suspend.